Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and on Delmarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM. And on this program today, we're going to talk everything about radishes as cover crops, which is really a more fascinating than you think, and what's happening with the gas pipeline going across metropolitan Baltimore. But first, we talk about the 30th anniversary of the signing of the Chesapeake Bay Agreement that was supposed to clean up the bay over the last 30 years. What is the reality, and what does it really mean? How does it affect our lives? We're here with Gerald Weingrad. Jerry Weingrad is a former Maryland State Senator who was there at the signing and was the environmental conscience of that legislative body when he was in it, an attorney, adjunct professor at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy, where he's taught a graduate course on the Chesapeake Bay restoration since 1988. And Beth McGee joins us. Beth McGee is senior scientist at the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. And Jerry Weingrad and Beth McGee, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you can all join us here at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. You can tweet at Mark Steiner. 410-319-8888 is the number to call. Let's just jump right into it. I knew this anniversary was coming up. Then I received an email with the article that you wrote, Jerry Weingrad, the op-ed you put in the paper, and some other pieces that came out. And I remember that I was going back through my old emails and looked at an email you and I exchanged when you came on the show 5 years ago on the 25th anniversary of the Chesapeake Bay watershed, and you were talking about the danger signs of what we were not doing then. And the sense is, from reading what you've written now, is some of those danger signs that you and many others, including former Governor Harry Hughes, are saying we need to watch out for, were not listened to.
Sadly, that's correct.
So talk a bit about where you think it is. What were the hopes you had 30 years ago when you saw this sign, and what's the reality of the moment we're standing in?
Well, back on December 9th, 1983, I was serving my first year in the Maryland Senate. I was much younger then, and we all, there were 700 folks there, was overflowing. I mean, Jacques Cousteau was one of the headliners, and all of us, the governors, the U.S. senators, the state legislators, all of the folks involved, really thought that this was the kickoff for an effort led by Harry Hughes that would take maybe a decade and we would turn this around and stop the significant decline of our fisheries, our oysters, our crabs, and our rockfish and shad and our bay grasses, and once again have a bay that wasn't back to John Smith's time in 1607, but at least it was back to the 1950s level. And we are all sadly disappointed, those that have really been engaged in this for 3 or 4 or 5 decades, all of us are really upset. And most of the folks who are in their 70s or 80s or like me, my late 60s, we see this as a heritage issue. And the political reality is that folks are not as committed to the Bay today. And you can see that just from the Chesapeake Executive Council. One of the things the half-page agreement did was agree to start a bay program, that the bay was polluted, that there were serious problems, and to address this, and they agreed to a Chesapeake Executive Council and a bay program. Now, Ronald Reagan, in his January 1984 State of the Union address, mentioned the Chesapeake Bay and said he established a $10 million fund that created the Bay Program and the EPA Bay Office that's now up to a budget of over $50 million. But what happened was is this executive council is supposed to meet every twice a year. The last meeting, when they were going to honor the 30th anniversary, most of the governors didn't even show up. The head of the EPA that's part of this and signed the original agreement back then, their head at that time, didn't show up. And furthermore, they were to have a new Bay agreement that was to have some teeth in it and move us forward. They couldn't even agree on that. So it was a nothing burger, barely even reported in the press. And then the O'Malley administration withdraws sensible regulations for manure that's being dumped on land all over the Eastern Shore. And that goes down when they have pledged to the EPA under the pollution diet that in 2011 these these regulations would be adopted to limit dumping chicken manure and other manures that already have a lot of phosphorus in them on soils that are already saturated with phosphorus. So when you look at all these signs, it is a very depressing time for us.
So, and Beth, let me bring you into this, Mickey, and you're looking at this. I mean, I think that clearly the goals have not been met. There seems to be kind of a lack of interest in the parts of other states who signed this, especially Virginia and Pennsylvania, where a lot of the pollution for the bay comes from, a good part, some of it does in the watershed, clearly, Pennsylvania. And we're going to talk about some of the specifics, but what's your assessment?
No, I think we very much agree with Gerald. I don't think anybody's satisfied with the restoration progress over the last 30 years. And in fact, that's one reason why in 2009 that the Chesapeake Bay Foundation filed suit against EPA, because we thought that sufficient progress wasn't being made and that EPA wasn't using their full authority under the Clean Water Act in order to compel the states to action. So I would say we are equally disappointed, but we're also somewhat optimistic because of that lawsuit and the Clean Water Act. We now have pollution limits in place, and the states have developed plans to achieve those limits over time with a 2025 deadline, and they're working to implement those plans. But we agree that certainly the fact that we didn't have a large representation of the governors and the executives of the Bay States at the recent Executive Council meeting does bring into question the commitment that all the Bay States have towards, you know, achieving a restored Bay.
So I'm going to talk about this question of optimism about the future just by looking at where we've come to and what's happened recently. I mean, we did a program the other week on the regulations that were going to be put into effect on farms and how those were withdrawn by the O'Malley administration with very little dust up about it, even in the environmental community. We've seen that, and then you see how the what's called the flush tax was passed, which we really debate on just the other week as well, and the was supposed to generate over $1 billion, but what happens is that many of the localities are not enforcing it and say we're not going to. So and these are two of the major issues we face, both the runoff from developments and the and with what's happening on our farms. And it seems that for whatever reason, we don't have the political wherewithal or to move ahead. And maybe in some ways falling back because we're seeing dead zones. I mean, so what's the politics of this, Jerry? What's blocking this from happening?
Well, the easy choices and the easy methods have already been used. Like, I fought for the phosphate ban for 2 years, and it was opposed by the administration, even back then, of Harry Hughes, believe it or not, the first year of the Bay in 84. And finally, we got support in the environmental community and the administration. We got it enacted in 85, and it spread to D.C., Virginia, Pennsylvania very quickly. And that one saved tens of millions, probably by now over $100 million in sewage treatment, and no one's clothes are falling off their backs, which the industry predicted. So we did that. The flush tax was a very bold action. It was enacted under the last Republican governor without a lot of opposition from the public or the counties, and it, in fact, is a singular success in the Bay cleanup is our ability and our willingness to spend the $1.4 billion here in Maryland on top of other improvements that have been made to remove nitrogen and phosphorus, the two key pollutants poisoning the Bay, from sewage. And that's at 95% of the wastewater flow, the 67 largest plants. And everyone right now, whether they know it or not, every single individual household is paying at least $60 a year, and businesses are paying even more depending on their water flows. We have not done similar methods for the cleanup of what are called non-point sources, not pipes. Industry and sewage treatment plants have led the way. That is the singular success of the Bay cleanup program. But the non-point sources, the agricultural runoff that chokes and kills the Bay and is the number one source of pollution, has not been aggressively addressed. The environmental community has not been aggressive in pursuing ag pollution. It's hard to find any major group other than the River Keepers and the Clean Water Watch that have ever sued or prosecuted a case against agriculture. And secondly, stormwater runoff from urban areas, developed areas like Baltimore City, Anne Arundel County, parts of Prince George's, Montgomery, the heavily developed areas, kills their waterways because it's full of pollutants, and we have not aggressively addressed stormwater. And the restoration fund that was created for that, where the state legislature did not have the gumption or the guts or the governor to pass a statewide bill enacting a similar parallel to the flush tax that would evenly and fairly have everyone pay a fee for stormwater runoff to restore our creeks and streams. Instead, they dropped it on 10 counties, and some of the counties imposed a $1 or 1 cent a year fee, like Frederick County, Carroll County, thumbed their nose at the state. There's no suit. There's no actions by the state to make them comply, and we're killing our waterways by farm pollution and urban runoff, which has not been addressed, is not being aggressively addressed, and will never restore the bay unless we do more on agriculture and the stormwater.
So, I mean, if it's true, Beth, that like half of the 4.3 million acres of land that are cropped here are undertreated, that they're not, and that this is pouring into the bay, that we don't have any teeth in this flush tax, apparently, because we gave it to the counties and cities. And one of the things we learned over the years in counties and cities is that developers are very powerful in those communities, because everybody needs property taxes because they want to develop and have a budget, so they allow developments, and that's caused the stormwater runoff. That combined with kind of pushing hard on this nutrient management. I mean, so do you think that's true? Are we overlooking something? Is something missing here?
No, I think that Gerald points out that we've really gotten reductions from the low-hanging fruit, so it's treatment plants, you know, which are well-regulated, and we've done a great job there. So what's left really is the hard stuff. Agriculture, for one, that, you know, one of the issues legally with agricultural runoff is that it is specifically exempted under the Clean Water Act. That's not to say that there aren't portions of agriculture that are not regulated. They are under the Clean Water Act, and we could certainly do more there. But that is one of the hindrances or obstacles that we face, is we don't have, like we had for wastewater treatment plants, we don't have this legal tool clearly spelled out in the Clean Water Act by which we can require more reductions. So agricultural has done some reductions there, somewhere about halfway to achieving their goals, but clearly they need to do more, and there's many ways that we can achieve that, some of which is hoping to provide funding for them to do conservation, and perhaps the regulations that you mentioned that were withdrawn. It's our understanding that it's a temporary withdrawal. We're hopeful that they will be reinstituted, but I guess that remains to be seen. On the stormwater side for urban areas, again, that's a challenge. We're certainly fighting a big backlash from local governments in who are desiring to implement or not that that regulation in terms of getting money to pay for what's the most expensive thing we need to do for bay restoration, which is reducing urban and suburban stormwater from our cities and towns. So it's a challenge. But you know, I'm the eternal optimist, and I think that one reason we're seeing the pushback we are, especially on the urban, the polluted runoff side, urban stormwater polluted runoff, is because we're getting real about bay restoration. Is that we're actually requiring more of our citizens, more of our farmers, and whenever you're faced with changing your way of business, there's always, I think, a backlash. So I view the fights that we have in front of us as sort of good news, bad news. The bad news is we're getting a lot of pushback. The good news is we're getting pushback because we're trying to do the right thing.
Jerry, I have another question here, but I'd like to hear your response to that.
Well, the simple fact is that under the Clean Water Act, large animal operations are fully covered and treated as a point source of pollution. So environmental groups have the river keepers sued unsuccessfully in the case, the Hudson Farms case on the Eastern Shore, where the governor of the state of Maryland actually chastised and actually the legislature, without his objection, started to penalize the University of Maryland Environmental Law Clinic for representing this needy client, this client that's right about suing these polluters on a chicken farm on the Eastern Shore that were, no question, grossly polluting the waters there. And the legislature's response was to take it out of the hide of the University of Maryland Law School because of their nastiness of them actually representing a group that was who would dare challenge the chicken industry and sue Purdue and sue a chicken producer for polluting the waters of the state. So clearly, the Clean Water Act does permit these lawsuits under the Clean Water Act. And one of the most recent articles by Tim Wheeler in The Sun from the Center for American Progress, from a law school professor who works that for that group, Professor Steinzer, found that even under the regulations that the state had to adopt to regulate chicken farms and other large manure producers, that there was a gross failure to enforce these laws, and many of the farms did not even have Clean Water Act required permits for the operation of these manure operations. I have not heard one single word from the environmental community about suing the state or these farms for violating the state laws and the Clean Water Act up for the manure. So basically, Big Chicken has its way with this governor, with this legislature, and essentially the environmental community has been feckless in responding aggressively to this. Now, Bethlehem Steel was sued years ago by CBF, one of the biggest settlements, and they should have been sued for grossly violating Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, and even hazardous waste laws. And there was over a $1 million settlement. They were sued again. They went out of business eventually, and they reacquired. It had more to do with international steel prices and competition in the mill there. There used to be 30,000 people employed there.
Right.
Now, when they went out of business, there were 2,100 hardworking people, some of them third and fourth generation people that had worked at the mill. And the point I'm making is, while all the environmental community, most people honor farmers and honor people that produce our food, and I'm one that's loves to eat, you know, I like my beer that comes from grains and hops that are grown on farms, and I like my food. But the thing is that today's production agriculture has graduated to a level after the 1940s and 50s, the Green Revolution, that we have intensified agriculture so much with the use of chemical fertilizers that was unforeseen even 50, 70 years ago. And that intensive agriculture coupled by these farms that produce incredible numbers. In 1 year, some farms produce over 1 million chickens. That manure, the cheapest thing to do with it is to dump it out on the soils. Now, you can imagine if you were just taking one small community where any of you live, where Beth lives, where you live, or where I live, and people collectively took their own manure and their pet manure and started dumping it out on their lawns. There would be such a hue and cry. They'd be arrested. There would be incredible things. But farmers can actually do that with almost impunity because of the failure of the environmental community to mount a challenge to these poor practices on farmland. And so that nugget right there is at the core of why we're failing on the Bay. The political will isn't there because we haven't educated the public and mounted this campaign. My final note would be, how bad does it have to get? My last straw was seeing my car mechanic, who I tried to get to have a bulb that burned out on my my Toyota Prius, which is a fairly extensive operation, believe it or not, and he was closed. He has one worker, but his shop was closed. I went again. I saw a sign he was in the hospital. I knew he had diabetes. I went back again. He had a young man working for him, said he was in the hospital. He's an avid fisherman and hunter, a waterfowl hunter. We talk about the environment all the time. He's a big NRA member. I called him. I got him. He said he was in the hospital. And I said, what happened? He was fishing with a friend, which he does frequently, at the mouth of the South River, right near CBF headquarters and right near where I live, and right near where it flows into the bay. And they were catching white perch. They were catching spot, some other fish, and he said, let's get a few more so we'll have enough for dinner. He got a prick either from a spine of a rockfish, the fin, or from a hook, and the next morning, his finger was really sore. He put some antibiotic on it, a Band-Aid. In 4 days, he had to be admitted to a hospital in Easton. He lives on the shore now, and he had chronic wasting disease from one of the bacteria in the water during the summer months, early September, heated up and made toxic by these chemicals from stormwater, from agriculture, from all this runoff, and from sewage too, and his leg was being eaten from the inside out. He was been hospitalized off and on for 6 weeks. He has to still, 2 months, 3 months after the injury, he still has to take a pint of blood a week. He's still bleeding. He can't. He uses a walker. He hasn't been working. He lost months of work and income.
And so, I'm sorry, Joe. We don't have a lot of time left. This is. Yeah. This, I mean, so and a lot of this is put at the at literally because of the state of our bay. And what we've not covered. So, Beth, when you hear Jerry, do you think that he may be that there's a strong point here that both the environmental community and others are not kind of informing the public and standing up the way they need to?
No, I wouldn't agree with that. You know, I think for if we go back to agriculture, I think it's a much more complicated issue than that Gerald is indicating. We certainly have some big farms that are regulated under the Clean Water Act, but quite frankly, if you look watershed wide, and even in certain parts of Maryland, a lot of the farms are small. We're talking 50 or 100 head of dairy cows, for example, in South Central Pennsylvania and the Shenandoah Valley. So so there are many solutions. There are many problems. There are many solutions. I don't think it's as simple as let's just go sue agriculture. I think it's much more complicated than that. That said, you know, he raises a good point, which is that this is an issue that's not just about the ecology of the bay. It's about human health. People are getting sick from swimming, and it's because we have polluted runoff coming from our city streets and from our agricultural fields, and we have overflows of sewage treatment plants. So from that perspective, we completely agree that we something more needs to be done. And, you know, at the Bay Foundation, I'm confident we always look at all the tools in our toolbox, whether it's litigation, whether it's advocacy, whether it's grassroots, to accomplish what is our motto, which is to save the Bay.
So we have only a couple minutes left in this segment. I think what would be good to do, though, in the coming weeks, is to bring our guests back here, as well as some people who represent the farming interests and people who represent different farming interests, and really have a major hour long conversation looking at this. Because I think we need to put it on the table before the state legislative session comes into being. And to raise these issues and just see what we all think. We have literally like a minute and a half left. Jerry, a very quick thought on our way out. If we can get back to Beth, that'd be great.
Well, you know, we're a very blessed country. It's one of the few civilizations that's been able to produce more food than it needs to feed its people. We export food. We're so productive. We spend $6 billion a year to subsidize growing 40% of our corn crop, which is one of the most polluting crops you can grow, one of the most polluting land uses for nitrogen flow, to put in our vehicles, an environmental and economic boondoggle. And we are so productive that we have so massively polluted our waterways, particularly on the eastern shore from agriculture and from stormwater and all the other flows from sewage treatment plants, that the bay remains severely degraded. We're in violation for most of the waters of the bay. Close to 90% of the waters of the bay don't even meet basic Clean Water Act standards 30 years after the agreement. We're in violation of federal law. That's why the EPA is supposedly making us do these things. We have a collapsed shad fishery. There's been a moratorium in Maryland for over 30 years that has not been restored. The oyster fishery has collapsed. You go on, the bay grass has declined 15,000 acres in 2012, one of the lowest levels since 1986. You have a fishery for fish, like the crab fishery, is teetering right now. We had a collapse in that. This was the lowest year I've ever seen for crabs. How bad does it need to get until we take the necessary actions and the bold, vigorous things that need to turn this around? This is tragic.
We're just about out of time. Beth, let me have a last thought before we take a break.
I first of all, thanks for having us on. And I guess I just want to also point out that, you know, we're pointing towards agriculture and we're turning towards polluted runoff. But really, if we live in this region, we are impacting the bay. So to the extent that people can drive their cars less and fertilize less and do all the good things that they personally can take responsibility for, and probably the most important thing they can do is let their elected officials know that they care about the Chesapeake Bay. I think, Gerald Weingrad, it was a great advocate for the bay when he was in office, and it's because people voted for him and kept him in office. So I think that's one of the important things that your listeners can do to help us clean up the bay.
Beth McGee, senior scientist at Chesapeake Bay Foundation. Gerald Weingrad, you'll be hearing a lot more of him here on Sound Bites, former Maryland State Senator, attorney, adjunct professor in public policy at the University of Baltimore. Thank you both so much, and we will come back to this early January for a much longer and more intense discussion.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you both so much. We're going to take a brief break here on Sound Bites, and we're going to be joined by Theo Lagarda, who is a Gunpowder River keeper, as we look at a pipeline being built that we don't hear much about, but you need to know about. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner here on The Mark Steiner Show and on Soundbites, our weekly look at food, farming, and the environment here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and on Marvel Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM. We are now joined by Theo Lagarda. Theo is a Gunpowder River keeper, and we've been talking about this issue off air a lot together about a gas pipeline being built across the Baltimore metropolitan area, which has not gotten a lot of press. We asked the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to join us. They originally said yes, but then they said they gave us a statement which we'll be part of, unless FERC would come on, which is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And FERC said no, they wouldn't come on. So the Army Corps of Engineers said no, they wouldn't come on. And the Maryland Department of the Environment that would issue these permits as well also would not come on, but Theo Lagarda came on, and he's here in studio. Welcome, Theo.
Thank you, Mark.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook page or tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. So we need energy. So from your perspective, what is the big deal about this pipeline, and why don't we know more about it?
Well, it's an interesting issue. Columbia Gas Transmission Company, which is a subsidiary of NiSource, Inc., has been proposing a pipeline that crosses Baltimore County and Harford counties. It's 21 miles long. About 70 waterways will be crossed, including the main stem of the Gunpowder River, and it will impact about 305 acres of land. So when we talk about natural gas as another source of energy, what often isn't discussed are the cumulative impacts of natural gas on the environment.
So, but what is it about? Why have you kind of stood up around this issue? And what are the issues you think that are critical that clearly those who regulate at this moment don't want to talk about?
It's a fair question. I think that I initially was at a meeting where not a lot of information was disclosed about the impacts to the waterways. And it was a meeting that was held as part of the federal process. But there were a lot of questions that I left with related to how the pipeline would cross these waterways and how the state and the Corps of Engineers would actually make the project protective of the environment. Those questions largely are still unanswered. But I serve as Gunpowder River Keeper. As your last guest, Jerry, mentioned, we have been leading the charge on clean water in the Chesapeake Bay region, and we do it in rivers that we're intimately familiar with. So we tend to work on the waterways that we live and work and recreate in, and our members support us to make sure that impacts to these waterways are addressed.
So when we get a note from the Corps of Engineers that says their primary goal is to protect the nation's aquatic resources with reasonable impacts through fair, flexible, and balanced permit decisions that recognize the essential values of the nation's aquatic ecosystems. We are charged with balancing economic and environmental factors by weighing input from the applicant, local, state, and federal agencies, elected officials, interest groups, and the public. The Corps is neither a proponent nor opponent of any project. We assess the benefits and detriments of each proposal using the input we receive and balanced against the regulations we are charged with administering and then render a permit decision. In the case of NiSource, Columbia Gas Project, we are reviewing the proposal under Section 404, which we explain, of the Clean Water Act, impacts on the waters of the United States, including jurisdictional wetlands. They said there's been public public access to this in terms of public input. As background, the Corps has issued a joint public notice with the Maryland Department of Environment on April 15, 2013, for NiSource gas project and held joint public hearings on May 21st and in Falston and May 23rd in Owings Mills, and we continue to receive comments on this. So your response to that?
My response would be that not enough people have been engaged in this issue as it relates to the actual water body impacts. And
what does that mean, water body impacts? What are you talking about?
When we're talking about water bodies, it could be a wetland, it could be a seep or a spring. It's not just a stream or a river. It's really anything that's wet. So a lot of these waterways that are crossed by the project are able to support trout as a designated use. And the state and the Corps typically recognize these designated uses that EPA or the Environmental Protection Agency gives to these water bodies so that the state can protect them. But what's missing, Mark, is the public participation in this regulatory process. Because as I noted in a letter to the Corps of Engineers back in May, what is missing is the waterway impacts as it relates to drinking water supply. And of the 70 streams that are crossed by the project, 39 have been identified as drinking water supply streams. So these trout waters and the drinking waters are essentially combined in a way that is giving us a sense that there could be impacts.
And we're talking about the drinking water for the almost the entire metropolitan Baltimore region, Baltimore City and the surrounding suburbs.
Right. So we have about five counties and Baltimore City. It's about 1.8 million people all told. And the cumulative impacts, that is, the pipeline is not the impact.
I would say this 26-inch pipeline is more than that in terms of what you're concerned about.
Right. It's not the 26-inch pipeline, which is about the size of a bicycle tire. It's the fact that that Columbia Gas is going to have to take a 75 to 100-foot right-of-way and knock all the trees out and knock all of the shrubs out and essentially put this pipeline in and then cover it up.
And you're worried about what? The physical pipeline? Could it pollute waters? It could leak? I mean, what are the issues that are literally at the root of, no pun intended, the opposition or the questioning of the efficacy of this pipeline?
Sure. One of the methods and the only method that the applicant, Columbia Gas, has suggested that they use to put this pipeline in is an open trench method where they take a track hoe, a big excavator, and dig a trench and put the pipeline in across these waterways and cover it up. So that brings up a lot of environmental impacts as it relates to sediment and erosion of the stream banks and the removal of vegetation. You know, an adult tree can handle about 40 gallons of stormwater in a one-inch rain event. If we don't have that adult tree that's about 26 inches in diameter, we don't have that stormwater control that is already naturally occurring.
So, well, why is it that we aren't hearing more about this? And what is the do you think there's a reticence to have more public hearings? Do you think there should be more public input? Well, what are you suggesting?
Yes, I absolutely do think there's a reluctance from both the part of Maryland Department of the Environment and the Corps of Engineers to engage the public in this regulatory process. It is federal. That is, this process, because it is going to involve eminent domain. People's backyards are being taken by this pipeline right of way. In some cases, their septic fields. In some cases, their front porch or a barn or an outbuilding. The people that were engaged in this process by, in a federal sense, were engaged because a public notice was sent out by the Corps of Engineers and the Maryland Department of the Environment on the 404-401 joint permit application. But the waterways that were described in the joint notice only indicated that the pipeline project would impact trout waters of the state. Now, you could ask how many people trout fish.
Well, who cares about the trout, right?
And how many people drink water in Baltimore?
So how do you think the water that the people just blocked from the studio in Northeast Baltimore could be affected by the construction of this pipeline?
Well, currently, Loch Raven is where a lot of the water comes from. The Gunpowder River flows into Loch Raven. And again, 39 of the 70 waterways crossed by the pipeline flow into Loch Raven or become sources of water for people that live on wells that are slightly upstream, you know, of Loch Raven. Loch Raven's currently under a pollution diet for sediment and phosphorus. This construction project with this 26-inch pipe is going to comprise 305 acres of land directly upstream of Loch Raven. So there's a lot of potential for harm related to more sediment, more phosphorus. When we talk about sediment, the biggest issue is really capacity with Loch Raven. As this project continues, the only thing that's going to be really keeping sediment from flowing into Loch Raven are silt fences. And I'm not really convinced that that's the safest way to protect city drinking water.
I think what we're saying here is important on a number of levels. I mean, because when things happen in places that you don't see, that are not physically in your backyard, we cannot think about them and dismiss them. You know what I'm saying? I mean, because it affects somebody's stream, because it affects somebody's barn in somewhere in Baltimore or Harford County, why should people in downtown Baltimore or northeast Baltimore or east Baltimore, west Baltimore care? But you're describing why people should care, because it's all connected. It's the water that people are drinking here in the city being and where we are broadcasting from, as well as people being affected in the surrounding counties all around the Chesapeake Bay.
Absolutely. We make a lot of efforts to engage people into thinking about this water as essential. The surface water, you know, that flows through Baltimore and Harford County, 100% of it ends up in someone's well or ends up in the city's public drinking water supply. Yet the Corps of Engineers and MDE have done nothing to engage the Baltimore City Department of Public Works in this project. That should concern your listeners.
They have not been engaged?
They have not been engaged.
Have they said anything about not being engaged?
They have not.
They have not?
No.
But part of this is also I mean, there's a connections people aren't making entirely, which it may not be a connection at all, but I think that they deserve kind of a look in a conversation. People are arguing about whether fracking should be allowed in Western Maryland. Majority of the gas that we see coming in comes from fracking in West Virginia and Pennsylvania. That would probably go through this pipeline. And that all has to do with what could happen in Cove Point with the building of a plant that people are questioning there as well. So there are connections here we're not looking at.
Right. I mean, a rainfall event doesn't happen with one drop. So when you think about all of these things combined, the real question is the federal government and the state government that's charged with protecting these resources, whether it's drinking water or, you know, areas of scenic beauty, areas of recreation, farmland that's very viable to the state. Are the agencies that are charged with protecting the environment doing it in a way that engages the public? Because my sense is if the public's engaged in a process, the process gets better. But right now there isn't much course for engagement.
So what are you suggesting should happen then? A, in terms of how the public can become engaged, even though the process isn't necessarily open right at the moment for that engagement. I mean, what do people do? What should the response be other than the Gunpowder Riverkeeper standing up against the authorities saying we have to do more before you build this pipeline?
Well, we did engage some other conservation organizations back in October, and right around Halloween we sent out a press release to urge the Army Corps of Engineers and Maryland Department of Environment to disclose these waterway impacts and to essentially have a proper public notice that would talk about drinking water impacts. I think that that's the first step in getting more people engaged in this process. So of the 17 other nonprofits, only 5 were riverkeepers or waterkeepers. The rest were folks like Food and Water Watch, the Maryland Environmental Health Network, community associations. You know, these are people and groups that aren't necessarily riverkeepers, but they are interested in waterway impacts. Citizen Shale, who's been concerned about fracking, and Clean Water Action also signed on this letter. And I think that it would be important for your listeners to engage with Senator Mikulski's office and Senator Cardin's office to ask for more public participation with this public notice.
So is there a place people can go website-wise?
Yes. If they go to Gunpowder Riverkeeper's Facebook page, we have a narrative map, a storytelling map, if you will, on all of the waterway impacts.
A really good one.
and it has the environmental assessment from FERC, from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. It also has the deficient public notice that the Corps of Engineers and MDE put out and letters that we've written to the Corps and MDE that they have not responded to.
So we will have all that on silentshow.org website, and we'll come back to this in the coming weeks to look at where we have come to and what has to be done and what progress has been made or not made. I want to thank Theo Lagarder for coming into the studio, Gunpowder Riverkeeper, as we look at this Columbia gas pipeline and the effect it will have on our drinking water here where these studios are, drinking water in the entire metropolitan area. It's not just an issue about our trout. It's an issue about the water you drink and the water you give to your children. Theo, thank you so much. Good to see you.
Thank you. And Mark, you remember this, if you remember anything. You don't want dead trout in your drinking water. And these trout are like those canaries in the coal mine. So they are good indicators of water quality. We have some of the best water quality in the Mid-Atlantic. We want to keep it that way.
Thank you, Theo Lagarder, Gunpowder Riverkeeper. We're going to take a very brief break. When we come back from this very brief break, we are going to be joined by Dr. Stuart Schwartz talking about radishes. Why? You'll find out. Welcome back to Soundbites and the Mark Steiner Show here. We are about to talk to Dr. Stuart Schwartz, who is a senior research scientist at the Center for Urban Environmental Research and Education at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. That's UMBC. He was going to make a live appearance last week, but all kinds of weird things happened. We didn't have a show because of the snow, but he's making a phone appearance. Stuart, welcome. Good to have you on the program.
Thanks, Mark. Good to be here.
So, radishes. It's interesting. I was talking to some people who actually kind of seeded their farm with different things to try to control runoff. But this idea of radishes is something that sounds so simple, yet talk a bit about this research.
Sure. We've been looking more broadly at sort of the hydrologic function of the urban landscape and how much runoff is coming from our pervious lands and vacant lots in particular. And some research that my colleague Ray Weil at University of Maryland College Park has been doing led us to look at an Asian radish called the daikon radish, also called a forage radish. This is a radish, but it's not the little round ball you're used to seeing in the supermarket. This can grow with a growth form that looks somewhere between a fat carrot and an eggplant.
Can you still eat them?
Absolutely. It's actually considered a delicacy in Asian cuisine.
Just checking.
and it's got a very long taproot. It'll put down a taproot that can be up to 4 feet deep, and it's able to penetrate pretty compacted soils.
Now, what's the relationship between that and that being used as a cover crop to capture runoff?
Absolutely, yeah. So the work that Ray's been doing for the last 15 years was using forage radish in agricultural settings as a cover crop, something that's planted in the fall and the winter to soak up that excess nitrogen that's left over after summer corn. It dies off in the winter with a hard frost, and that nitrogen is released, and it's available for spring crops. But because of that taproot's ability to penetrate compacted soil, what Ray was able to show is that the spring crops were able to grow their roots deeper in soils that are already compacted without requiring deep tillage to break up compaction. The connection is that we've been looking at compacted soils in Baltimore, in residential yards and vacant lots, because that compaction reduces infiltration and creates a lot of stormwater runoff. We can go in with heavy equipment and heavy steel blades and rip and decompact that soil, but the thought was if we could grow forage radish in the right environment and its roots could also get through that compacted soil, die off in the winter, and leave open pores, that's a very natural, low-cost way to make that soil spongier and more absorbent and restore infiltration without having to bring in bulldozers and ripping blades.
So what you're talking about is not just for farms using these radishes as a cover crop.
Exactly.
You're talking about this could be used in the urban landscape in vacant lots and other places to also absorb runoff. Is that right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And in fact, we're working on a project that we're just going to be starting next year with Maryland State Highway Administration to plant the same daikon radish or this forage radish on some of their medians, again, as a low-cost, cost-effective way of reducing the compaction and increasing the infiltration, trying to get more stormwater management from that pervious or green landscape than it's currently providing.
And I get from what I've been reading that this is also, compared to other ways of doing things, is relatively low cost.
That's right. That's right. The seed is, we can buy a 50-pound bag of seed, depending on the mix we get, for under $100. The seeding rates are typically 8 to 10 pounds per acre, so you can typically cover a lot of ground with an inexpensive bag of seed. And the idea that we're testing is whether or not we can go out to these deeply compacted green spaces that really are producing runoff rather than absorbing rainfall, and every year just broadcast seed the radish, and over a couple of years have it loosen up and open up that soil and make it much more absorbent than it is today.
So I'm just out of curiosity. So when you do this, what happens to the radishes once it's done and we go into a new season? Can people actually eat these radishes, or are they contaminated?
Well, no, they're certainly edible. There may be some issues that people want to look into in terms of, contaminated urban soils and lead content and things of that nature. But the primary objective is to let these radishes get killed off naturally by a tough winter frost. Once they're killed by frost, they slowly decay, and they leave these large, think of this eggplant sitting in the soil rotting away, releasing whatever nitrogen is bound up in it and leaving behind it a big pore with a deep channel 4 feet deep that water can get down into and new plant root growth can follow.
And because the reality is what we face here is, what rains do in urban areas, let's say, because we're talking about urban area right now, is that whether it's fertilizer or organic matter or any other pollutant that might come down, kind of wash into our riverways, but this is a way to capture it. And you're actually doing experiments with Civic Works and other places on the east side of Baltimore and Clifton Park to see how this works, right?
That's exactly right. So we put in our first trial plot this past fall. We got it in the ground a little bit late, so we're not going to get that deep root effect, but we just wanted to do it as a proof of concept and planning on coming back next fall, planting it in about mid to late August is the optimal time to plant it. And we're thinking that just this repeated planting on vacant lots and highway medians and areas like that in a couple of years might be able to have a very, very significant effect. And the counterpart to that is we've also been going out and measuring infiltration and soil compaction in the so-called pervious or green landscape. And what we consistently find is that just the nature of land transformation, the way we build, is leaving us with green spaces that are probably best characterized as grass growing in a thin veneer of soil on compacted fill. So there's much less hydrologic function, more runoff being produced from our pervious lands than we think, and we think this might be a tool in the toolbox to help reverse that.
So you really do see this, isn't it? This mass planting, the possibility of mass planting of these daikon radishes in urban suburban areas, maybe also as well on farms, as having a real effect on stormwater runoff that goes into the bay and the rivers.
Yeah, we think it has enormous potential, and really the studies we're doing in partnership with Baltimore DPW and the Office of Sustainability and Civic Works, that are our great partners, is to really document those effects and see how much of a difference could this make and see where are the best areas to try it at, what we think will be a very modest cost.
Dr. Stuart Schwartz is a senior research scientist at the Center for Urban Environmental Research and Education at UMBC, the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Joined us for this segment here on Soundbites, the Mark Steiner Show. Stuart Schwartz, thanks so much. This has really been fascinating.
Thank you, Mark. Good to chat with you.
We're looking forward to updates.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you so much. And thank you all for listening to Soundbites and the Mark Steiner Show here. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are productions of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and find out more about our guests and what they're talking about, the papers and ideas they're working from that you heard in the show, please visit us at the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download all of our programming on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA, the voice of the community, and WSTL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.